Welcome to Australia's Future with Tony Abbott. I'm Daniel Wilde from the Institute of Public Affairs. Australia is facing its most significant challenges since World War II. Geopolitical tensions are increasing, cultural self-confidence is in decline. The values which define us, freedom, democracy, egalitarianism, and sacrifice, are being put to the test. Over this special podcast series, Tony and I discuss how Australia can survive and flourish in the decades ahead.
Well, hello, Tony, and g'day to all of our listeners. Great to be back for another discussion with Tony Abbott for Australia's Future. Lots to talk about, as always. We'll be discussing the review of our defence capabilities and strategy, as well as the voice to Parliament. Tony, great to be with you. Let's kick off with the Defence Strategic Review, yet another review in the defence space. It's being billed by the government as the biggest shake-up of our defence strategy and capability in decades. I think the rhetoric in it is probably fair enough. There's heightened uncertainty, heightened chance of conflict in our region. But in terms of the substance, it appears to be pretty similar to the review undertaken by Morrison in 2020. Look, just at a headline level, I just keen to get your assessment on the review and whether you think it's hit the mark or not.
Daniel, first the good news. The government has got the fundamental problem right. The fundamental problem is that our region, our world is becoming more and more dangerous, and our armed forces are not ready for serious conflict. They've also finally identified the principal threat, which is communist China, which, as we know, is aiming to be the world's dominant power by mid-century, and in the meantime is aiming to overcome the so-called century of humiliation by taking Taiwan, democratic, peaceful Taiwan by force if necessary. So they've got the big things right. The problem with the review, as always with defence, is urgency. Now, it's a review that's produced more reviews. There's yet another review of the surface fleet due by the end of this year. There's yet another review of our need for a domestic missile manufacturing capability due sometime next year. We have no capability to move quickly on anything where defence procurement is concerned. And we need to be moving with breakneck speed. We need to be getting more ships, more planes, more missiles, and we need these in a matter of months, not years, not decades, because as all of the defence analysts are telling us, there could be conflict across the Taiwan Straits within a couple of years, not a couple of decades. So I suppose you've got to give them marks for getting the rhetoric right. But in the end, it's deeds, not words, that matter. As the Prime Minister said the other day, there is no more important task of government than the defence of the nation. But the defence of the nation has rarely looked as shaky as it does right now.
Yeah, Tony, you were a good friend of Senator Jim Molins, and we had a discussion with him as part of our podcast series and his perspective on defence. And he made a really good point, and this was one of his key insights on defence, which you can't just think about defence as its own thing. It's a whole of economy, whole of society type thing. And my concern is that this review and many other reviews don't think about the broader context, for example, energy supply, reliability, or our cultural willingness to fight for ourselves and many of these other broader issues. So it's not just missiles and tanks, which are important. There's a much broader issue here, isn't there?
I think you're right, Dan. We have had it so good for so long in this country. And I suppose right around the Western world, there was a sense after 1989 and the fall of the Berlin Wall, the conflict between nations had become a thing of the past. What we're seeing most brutally in Ukraine right now is that conflict between nations is not necessarily a thing of the past, and that large aggressive bullies are more than capable of waging devastating war against their smaller neighbours. So what's needed is not just a different mindset on the part of our defence planners. What's needed is a different consciousness on the part of our people. Now, Jim Molan once said to me that if we really wanted to shake things up, we would bring back some form of national service, because that would alert our people in a very real way to the need to give something back to our country, in particular, the prospect of having to fight for our country, because inevitably there would be a military dimension to national service. Something short of that that would be doable right now, which would at least start to alert people to the danger, would be to immediately start rotating our existing ships and planes through bases in southern Japan. It would send a signal to Beijing that Taiwan need not be alone, and it would put significant Australian military forces in theatre where they could be immediately useful should tensions rise across the Straits of Taiwan. And one of the important but largely unsung measures of the Morrison government, something that was started in my time but which Scott Morrison brought to fruition, was the status of forces agreement with Japan, which means that our armed forces can readily be based in Japan and their armed forces can readily be based here. So if the government wanted to put some real meat tomorrow into this strategic review, it would announce in conjunction with the Japanese government that it was looking to rotate substantial Australian air and naval forces through Japan on an ongoing basis.
And Tony, of course, we're talking today, and yesterday was Anzac Day, and it's a very important reminder of the, you know, the men and women that have sacrificed their lives for our nation and for our freedoms. Just wanted to get your thoughts. Did you have the opportunity to attend the service yesterday, and what's your reflections on Anzac Day?
Look, I was lucky enough to go to the last post ceremony at the War Memorial on Anzac Eve. And yesterday I went to the National March in Canberra, where we heard an excellent speech by Governor General David Hurley, who commanded the Australian contingent in Somalia 30 years ago. And General Hurley made the very important point that the men he led in Somalia were less worried about the dangers to themselves than they were about living up to the legacy of their forebears, the original Anzacs and those who'd served in the Second World War, Vietnam and elsewhere. And I guess that raises the great question, doesn't it? Are we up to them? Are we as capable as they were of rising to the challenge of serving our country in the ultimate way? I'm always heartened to see the enthusiasm of the marchers, the veterans, the currently serving military personnel. I'm always heartened to see the large numbers of enthusiastic people cheering them on. One of the really good things about contemporary Anzac Day is that it's a very multi-ethnic crowd. You see lots of diverse faces amongst the service personnel. And you certainly see the diversity of modern Australia in the crowds. I've got to say, and this is a bit parenthetical, I suppose, Daniel, but you almost never get a recent migrant who's down on Australia. The people who are down on Australia are normally the ones who've been here for many generations. And instead of being grateful for everything this country has given them, tend to say, oh, we got this wrong, we've done that wrong, and we're fundamentally illegitimate because it was all about an invasion and so on. But look, the challenge, I suppose, is to be as proud of our country every day as we are on Anzac Day. That's the challenge.
Yeah, it's a good point. I went to a service, a dawn service in the western suburbs of Melbourne, and there was probably about 3,000 people there at just a fairly modest RSL out there. So I think it's one of the days that still has a lot of resonance, and Australians are very keen to pay their respects to the past. I think that's a sign of hope for us.
It's the most important day in our civic calendar. Australia Day is important. There are various other things that we mark, I guess the Queen's birthday, Labor Day, grand finals, and things like that. But I think Anzac Day really is the preeminent day in our annual civic calendar.
I tend to agree, Tony. Look, just before we came on air, I was chatting to you about the Prime Minister's Anzac Day address. I was probably a bit more cynical or down on it than you were, so we'll have a quick chat about this. I just want to pull out one quote from the Prime Minister. that he said that was, to me, jarring. He said this, quote, "We must acknowledge the truth that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who donned the khaki fought harder for Australia than Australia was always, was sometimes willing to fight for them. Yet we learn and we keep taking steps forward together," end quote. I mean, I saw this plainly as a, you need to vote yes for the voice to be a good person and overcome our historical shortcomings. And in that sense, I thought it was very unbecoming of him and quite divisive. You had perhaps more of a charitable interpretation, so happy to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, Daniel, look, you can't really blame the Prime Minister, given his commitment to the voice, to be talking about the voice and, if you like, around the voice as often as he can. But I think he actually makes a fair point in that particular observation. Back at the time of the Great War, Indigenous Australians were not supposed to be allowed in our armed forces. Now, in fact, hundreds of them signed up and quite a few paid the ultimate price.
Mm-hmm.
There were decorated Indigenous war veterans from the Great War. But as we know, when they got back, they weren't accorded the same repatriation and other benefits that their non-Indigenous brothers were. So there was definitely discrimination back in those days. But for me, the interesting thing is, despite the discrimination, despite the institutionalised injustice, which did exist in Australia 120-odd years ago, very substantial numbers of Indigenous people still wanted to wear our country's uniform.
Mm.
So they were more conscious, if you like, of our unity than of our division. And to this day, there is a rather magnificent war museum in Cherbourg in central Queensland, which the local Indigenous community very, very proudly maintains, commemorating the efforts of Indigenous people from that community and elsewhere to sign up to fight for king and country. So look, I think the Prime Minister was perfectly entitled to say that some Indigenous people gave their all for our country, a country which didn't always recognise them as it should back then. There are different issues, such as this whole question of how we deal with so-called frontier wars in the War Memorial and so on, which I think are much more contentious and complicated than the point that the Prime Minister was, I think, making perfectly reasonably yesterday.
Okay, that's fair enough, Tony. Now, speaking of the voice, you've put in a submission. So there's a what's called a Joint Parliamentary Committee, which is notionally there to study the proposed question that would be put to Australians in the referendum. I say, you know, supposedly meant to do this because it's clearly stacked out in favour of the yes. If you look at the witnesses and members of the committee, it's just a yes groupthink festival. But nonetheless, you've put in a very... I think important submission. I think some of this was covered in the Australian Financial Review. Your comments about the sort of the House of Lords type scenario. But I wanted to talk about a different part of your submission, which is the veto component. And I'll just quote this to you from what you've written. Sometimes a right to be consulted amounts to a right to veto, at least to some voice backers, that's precisely what's intended, end quote. Now, that we've studied at the IPL, we've studied the New Zealand experience, which Albanese has pointed to as a model.
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly what has happened. Yeah. The right to be consulted is basically a right to veto.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted you to elaborate on that point because I think it's absolutely critical.
Well, the key thing, Dan, is the proposed section 129.2, which would come into the Constitution should this referendum, as currently drafted, to be carried.
Yep.
Section 129.2 provides that the voice has a right to make representations to the parliament and to the executive government on matters relating to Indigenous people. Now, this is effectively a right to make representations on everything.
Yeah.
Now, yes, the subsequent subsection 3 talks about parliament being able to make the rules, but specifically it provides subject to this constitution. So the right to make representation in subsection 2 overrides any subordinate things in subsection 3. So the right to make representations means that all significant decisions need to be advised in advance to the voice in reasonable time. The voice needs to be resourced sufficiently to be able to consider the matter carefully. And then if the voice chooses to make representations, the relevant decision maker is going to have to take them seriously. And quite possibly, if the relevant decision maker decides not to heed any advice from the voice, it may well then have to give the voice some kind of right of comeback. So at the very least, what this means is that all significant decision making is going to be much slower and much more cumbersome, and the whole apparatus of government is going to get bigger and more unwieldy. So there's time and expense added to decisions which are already, as we have seen with the Defence Review, incredibly constipated and extraordinarily expensive. So I don't think people realise just how substantial and extensive and ramifying this particular change is going to be should it be approved at a referendum. Now, you know, there's been all sorts of dismissive views expressed by, amongst others, the Solicitor General, who are desperate to minimise the difficulties here. I don't think that any provision of the Parliament specifying, for argument's sake, that the voice can only make representations on matters specifically relating to Indigenous people, and that these representations, notwithstanding that they're made, will not be binding. I mean, just imagine the Parliament passing a law such as that. It would be struck down in an instant, in an instant, by any conceivable contemporary High Court as fundamentally contradicting the intention and the clearly implied rights in Section 129.2. Any conceivable contemporary High Court faced with parliamentary legislation purporting to substantially limit the ability of the right, it would be laughed out of court on the basis that what would be the point of establishing the voice if its representations could be summarily ignored by the Parliament and the executive government.
Well, that's right, and that's why Albanese said it'd only be a brave government that would go against
exactly
the voice
right.
of Parliament. That's
exactly what it, right. And this is what the Prime Minister is doing here. On the one hand, he's telling voters that this is no big deal. On the other hand, he's telling the Indigenous leadership, the activist leadership, this is a very big deal indeed. And this essentially restores, in large measure, the sovereignty that you had illegitimately taken away from you in the years following 1788.
Yeah, well, I think that's right. And to me, this is a big issue because among all the issues you've raised and we've discussed, this will set reconciliation back for a couple of generations. I mean, this is something you've been intimately involved in when Prime Minister. And that's why I think that the no vote here is not just a matter of legality. It's really an act of love for your country to make sure that we're not setting back this important gender so far.
Dan, I think that our country is really going down the wrong path altogether on this. And I don't expect him at the 11th hour to have a change of heart. But I really do wish the Prime Minister would decide that he's on the wrong track and pull this whole thing. Because either way, there is going to be damage and division done by this. I think the least damage and division will be done by a successful no vote, because that will enable us to start again here and do recognition, if it's to be done, in a unifying way. But I do think we're very much on the wrong track. And I think that if you want to bring our country together, vote no to this divisive and dangerous voice. And then let's think again about how we might do this in a way that's got something in it for everyone. And as I've been saying quite a lot lately, if we wanted to amend the preamble to provide that we are one indivisible federal commonwealth with an Indigenous heritage, a British foundation, and an immigrant character under the Crown, that would be a wonderful way of saying to the world who we are. It would be a good way of, I suppose, highlighting the three essential pillars of modern Australia, and there'd be something in it for everyone, whether you've been here through your ancestors for 60,000 years or whether you're the most recent migrant.
Yeah, that's right, Tony. And just lastly, on the migrant point, I think this is an interesting issue because basically what the voice is saying is if you got here first, you get special rights. What does that mean if you came here last as a migrant? Does that mean you go to the back of the queue?
Well, I think there is that implication in all of this, and that's why I say that it's a little mystifying, particularly given our occasional scorn towards Mother England, that in this day and age we want to recreate something akin to the House of Lords here in Australia. That's to say a power institution determined by ancestry. I mean, last time anyone tried to do that in this country was William Charles Wentworth back in the 1850s.
The Bunyip aristocracy.
And it was laughed to scorn as the Bunyip aristocracy. Yeah. Well, why go down this path again?
Yeah. Well, Tony, I think we'll leave it there today. I know you've got to dash off to catch a flight. So really appreciate your time and your insights, and looking forward to keeping on chatting.
Good on you, man.
This is a production of the Centre for the Australian Way of Life at the Institute of Public Affairs. To find out more, visit australia.ipa.org.au.